a very stimulating session this morning, and I think it's clear that the question is not whether bioenergy is going to be a reality, but how it will become a reality, and that will be the focus of my presentation this morning. I will try and provide the magic crystal ball perspective on this, and I have kind of split this up in three parts, short-term perspective for the next 5 years, medium term, 5 to 10 years, and then for the longer term, beyond 10 years. And as with all magic crystal ball forecasts, the future will tell how this will play out, but I'll do my best to give my perspective. So for the short term, I think it's also clear from previous presentations that we're going to continue to see ethanol production from cornstarch being a major source of ethanol, currently about 6.5 billion gallons per year, and likely to flatten out at about 15 billion gallons per year in the next 5 years or so. We have to always remember that producers are business people. They're looking for a return on their investment. They don't want to invest heavily in a practice that is not going to give them a positive bottom line. So the benefit of using corn grain is that there is an alternative market for the starch as a food and feed source. I think right now it's also still a little uncertain what the oil companies are really doing. We saw with the elections last year that the price of gasoline and the price of crude oil is not all that tightly correlated. And cutting the oil, the gasoline price could undermine the ethanol industry. There is an uncertainty about the process of using alternative feedstocks, particularly the lignocellulosic feedstocks, whether we're going to end up with thermochemical pretreatment and fermentation, or pyrolysis and chemical catalysis, or simply combustion. And in Bruce Dale's talk, he showed the DOE investments with a little bit of everything. So all of these things contribute to focus on starch for the short term. And that will be predominantly in the Midwest, while perhaps sugarcane will become important in the southern U.S. as it is in Brazil. An impact on the market price of commodity crops is another factor that has to be taken into consideration. We see in evidence of the corn-based model there is a heavy focus of refineries in the Midwest. That pretty much, you know, when you put your money where you see the best opportunities. So another issue is the global perception of biofuels. This is an image from a protester in Chile at a biotechnology conference being concerned about food being used for ethanol, particularly in the U.S. And I think it's important to realize that the facts are not necessarily what matter. The perception can be just as important for the success of an industry, and we've seen that with the acceptance of GMO crops, that well, they may be great, but if the public is not interested for whatever reason, they may not be as successful as we would hope. So in the meantime, while corn maintains its position as primary feedstock, I think we'll see the development of alternative dedicated bioenergy crops, and that is somewhat challenging. And somebody who is working on developing improved crops for bioenergy production, there's a real challenge because there is no established process that you can base your selection of croplands on. There's also agronomic considerations that have to be taken into consideration. And as I've indicated here, these are all interrelated. It's not that there is a clear single path on how to do this. And for example, if we want to maximize the yield of our feedstock, whether that be starch, sugars, or cellulose, we need to know what the process is that the feedstock will be used in. And if it's a lignocellulosic feedstock, we need to know if we need to have high lignin for high energy value in a combustion process, or low lignin to enhance the hydrolysis of polysaccharides. A farmer ultimately has to plant the improved crops that we generate, and that will depend, as we have seen, largely on the climate and the soil conditions, the availability of water, how much fertilizer and pesticides you're willing to put on. Also, whether a farmer has to retool his farm equipment, he's going to be more likely to pick a crop that doesn't require heavy investment in special equipment. So all of this has to be figured out more or less simultaneously, and that's always more challenging than when there is already an established downstream process. So when we then look beyond the short term, I think we'll start to see a gradual shift to alternative crops. Again, keeping in mind that the producer will want to make money at the end of the day, so crops that offer a clear advantage because they are low input crops that give a reasonable output are going to be attractive. Marginal lands are obvious choices in this respect, and this is where I think we'll see the initial use of crops specifically bred for ethanol production, and also crops that require minimal retooling on the part of the farm side of things. So a couple of crops that fit this bill would be sweet sorghum and photoperiod sensitive sorghums that produce high amounts of biomass and sugar. So this would be appropriate in areas north of the sugarcane producing areas up into the Midwest. Switchgrass potentially in the plains, as new switchgrass varieties are being developed by various academic and industrial breeders. Corn, as already been mentioned, will remain important as a grain crop and will therefore produce lots and lots of abundant lots and lots of stover as an abundant source for lignocellulosic fuel. And then on the northeast, hardwood species, and the south, softwood species will be of interest. This is a willow plantation that is harvested in this picture pretty much like a typical row crop, and it's very productive and suitable in places like New England, up into Ohio as well. So then looking further into the future, I think eventually we'll see the establishment of an alternative fuel market. I'll come back to this, why I think that's happening, with an established processing scheme, or rather processing schemes. Some of the methods will become winners, and this reduces the risk associated with the feedstock production. I think there won't be much concern for competition with feed and food applications, and ultimately we'll see, I think, a patchwork of crops throughout the country, throughout the world, depending on the climate, the soil, and the local processing capability, and bioenergy as a part of an alternative energy solution that includes wind and solar, potentially hydrogen energy. So rotation crops is something that hasn't been mentioned very much, at least not this morning, and what has been mentioned is the risk of growing corn on corn on corn with yield losses and disease incidence that increases. So this is something that's important that cannot be overlooked, and I don't really know what will become good rotation crop here, whether it be oil crops. I accidentally put this under the heading legumes, but of course this can be oil crops in general, including canola or jatropha. The sweet potatoes and cassava have been mentioned as potential rotation crops, and it's unclear at this time what the market value of these crops will be. And again, they won't gain acceptance unless people can make money off of these crops. So I think this is something that has to be considered seriously. So I'll give some examples then on what's happening in terms of genetic improvement on these crops. Focus on C4 grasses because they're very efficient at capturing solar energy. We've heard this a number of times this morning. One of the issues there is that some of these crops, particularly Miscanthus, is not propagated by seed, so it may be a great biomass crop, but the initial cost of planting the cuttings needs to be offset ultimately by the good yield. And I think in cases like that, partnerships between the seed industry, producers, and ethanol plants may be one way to lower the threshold of making that initial investment. So increasing the biomass yield can be done through selection for height. This is a plot at Simmet with corn plants that are up to 4 meters tall. This is a mutant out of my collection that makes about 6 stems rather than the single stem we typically see, and makes also more ears. It's a little shorter, but I think this is just in an inbred background. This is a mutant that makes very different shapes of leaves. Leaves are more easily digestible in the hydrolysis scheme than stalks are, so this may be a way of making corn plants more amenable to bioprocessing. This is a brown midrib mutant, which has altered chemical composition in the leaves and stems, and is more easily processed. Here is a plot with the parental population on the left and an improved population that was selected for reduced lodging and insect resistance late in the season. You can see, based on the field technician here, that the height of these plants is much bigger. And when you process these plants, the stover of these plants, just simply by adding hydrolytic enzymes to the stover and measuring how much glucose you get, on the left in the red bar is an inbred control that these two brown midrib mutants were derived from. We see 50 to 100% increase per gram dry weight in fermentable sugars by simply adding these mutations, and these are some of these improved inbreds with lodging resistance, where we can get twice the yield of fermentable sugars as well. Sorghum is interesting, has been mentioned, high biomass. This is from a single plant, several big stems. Also brown midrib trait that can enhance sugar yield is indicated here. The dark bars are the brown midrib mutants and the green bars the normal controls. And woody species I mentioned are of interest. Very high biomass potential compared to the grasses, much easier to store. They've been designed to stick around for a long time, and that is a benefit, but it takes long to establish tree plantations, and including the breeding of these crops. So I'm involved in a project where we're looking at the genetic control of carbon partitioning in trees, trying to either improve the above ground or the below ground biomass production, and making the roots more resistant to degradation, and therefore generating a carbon sequestration source. And this is done through genetic approaches with a Pacros population between two different poplar species that are then genotyped and phenotyped in terms of various root traits, QTL mapping, and the genome sequence that I'm used to identify candidate genes that are validated through expression QTL studies. And this will ultimately allow us to redesign the way trees look and function. And this can also be applied to other types of crops depending on the types of mechanisms. So you get a complicated and long marketing chain when you start with the initial trait development all the way through ethanol distribution and animal feed distribution resulting from this. lots of different industries are involved, and industries that typically haven't worked together. So I think there's opportunities for strategic partnerships between these industries, and you're starting to see that. This is an ad from General Motors advertising their giant SUV that runs on ethanol. Now they are involved in a campaign with in several big cities where they are promoting E85, selling it at 85 cents a gallon. They're allowed to do this until the traffic gets too jammed up and the cops tell them to stop. This generates a lot of excitement and marketing for opportunities. The oil companies are rebranding themselves as energy companies. This is an ad from Chevron where you can play a game to power a city up until 2030 under various scenarios. Shell is partnering up with Iogen to produce ethanol from wheat straw. BP has just invested in a bioenergy center in California and Illinois. So there's lots of new developments going on, and that's exciting and I think important because we don't have a whole lot of time. So with that, I'd like to thank several funding agencies and a number of colleagues that have contributed to the work I've shown. And I started out with the magic crystal ball, and that's how I'll finish. So I'll, time will tell how whether this was a $20 or a $2 talk. But I am working on a book that's coming out in June on the genetic improvements of bioenergy crops that gives a nice overview of what's happening right now in about 15 different crops. Many of the people that contributed to this book are at the meeting, and that's a place where you can learn more. So thank you for your attention.
We're scheduled for a period of discussion. I think that could involve any of the speakers, at least since break. If you have questions, are there questions for the last speaker? Yes.
General question.
Go ahead.
Throughout the symposium this morning, we discussed efficiency, but I don't think we adequately discussed scale or time. And I was wondering, what annual quantity of biofuels can we expect to produce relative to what we're currently getting from fossil fuels? What does this mean about how much we need to focus on conservation in addition to production of renewable fuels? Because I think we're in a position to judge the production side, and that needs to inform strategies on
The question had to do with, it's a very broad question having to do with, I think, if I could reword it, how much importance is our biofuels really going to have in our supply of fuel, and versus something like conservation? Any speakers want to talk about that? Yeah, I thought so. I don't know. We'll probably need to leave it hanging. I think I would reword that as well. My own sense is to say, what, you know, can crops compete with other ways of converting solar energy to liquid fuel? And go ahead.
I'm already on record with the Aspen Institute publication recommending 100 billion gallons a year. So that's a pretty substantial amount.
So where are we with this 1 billion?
100?
Comparing to our consumption, it would provide 20-30%, and what in 2030? Well, to this symposium, this is my short comment. I came to perhaps gain some optimism in biofuels, but the last speaker showed that our future is not bright if we base only on biofuel, unless we have a car that in already a prototype of engine that actually could run 240 miles per hour.
Per gallon?
Per gallon. Yeah. So I think our future is in engineers' hands, because I think we can support engineers, but we cannot actually change our future. We have to base on engineers.
Yeah, it's this is going to be well, yes. we're getting into the we're getting into the spongy swamp of futurism here, and we probably need to avoid that trap. I think that these are interesting questions to think about. I don't think we can probably offer very much in terms of sound conclusions. It seems to me that, you know, the projected demand for liquid fuels in the world is expected to increase by 50% in the next, 15 years or something like that. I mean, this is not trivial. You know, China's going to add how many cars? And India will add how many cars? And the U.S. will add how many cars? Projections I've seen say that all of the savings that we might make, all of the improvements we might make in efficiency, at least in the near term, will be swallowed up by just having more vehicles on the road. And hydrogen might be a possibility. I think, well, the other forms that I mentioned earlier of capturing solar energy, which would include wind and solar panels, have some potential. You know, can we generate hydrogen with otherwise idle wind turbines when the grid doesn't need their power? These are the kinds of questions I think that people look at in the future. Is everybody going to have their own little hydrogen generator in their garage, and you can use cheap electricity at night to make hydrogen to run your car to work the next day? Can you get the 300 miles per gallon? The miles per hour one had me kind of interested there. I think they have those in Texas too, but but anyway, those are some of the questions that are coming. I don't think anybody expects this transition to be just a sudden transition and we're in bad shape and now we're in good shape. This is all going to play out over a long time with a lot of economic and political considerations, because our supply of liquid fuels is at some point going to come to the end. I think that the efficiency, just a comment, the efficiency of not only producing but of gathering bio-based fuels, biologically produced fuels, is never going to be one of the strong points if you compare it with bringing a unit train from the Powder River Basin, for example. But that doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means that I think efficiency, large-scale, wide-area production of biologically based fuels is just a self-defined problem. You have to get them somewhere. And maybe someday everybody will burn their switchgrass in the field, you know, and all you'll do is have the cable run over to the electric pole and put electricity back into the grid, instead of driving these things up and down the road. Literally, to take, you know, 5 or 10 tons of round bales down to the power plant is a model that just doesn't work, I don't think. These have to be, and this will always be a problem. Another comment, question?
Structural stability of plants if you're interfering with cell wall structure, as well
I think my perspective on this is that the cell wall is really not very well understood at this moment. There's all kinds of initiatives going on to get a better understanding, and you know, it's not something that has traditionally been used in selection. You know, we've always looked for grain, typically, or oil. So one of the slides I showed was from the breeding experiment, where you can get good lodging resistance and insect resistance and still get very good yields of fermentable sugars. So I don't think the recalcitrance and agronomic properties are necessarily highly correlated. I think you can have both benefits.
What's the status on processing woody tissue to ethanol?
You want opinion or a fact? This is about processing woody biomass. I don't think softwoods are ever going to be biologically processed. There's just too many inhibitors. I think they're better candidates for thermal conversion. As you go into the hardwoods, the higher lignin soft or hardwoods are probably still better conversion than the candidates for biological conversion. You can get the lignin compound. And I think biological conversion becomes the equal option for thermal conversion. I frankly think thermal conversion of grasses and residues is not a good idea because of the ash content. It just interferes with everything you want to do in thermal conversion. So that's a very rough way of looking at the world, but that's the way I look at it. Bob, do you want to disagree with that?
No, actually, I definitely would agree with that. That you're going to do the thermal chemical conversion for the softwoods. In addition to it being hard to retract, you just have all the bioinhibitors that are in those woods. But the woody crops do have that nice attribute that you can, they can stay in the field for a long time, and so you can adjust to the market, adjust to the weather,
yeah.
Et cetera. And that one, that whole handling issue with the grasses is huge because you've got to harvest at a specific time. You know, you have sort of a window, but you definitely don't have all year where you do have that woody crop. In terms of the one question about trying to look at the whole bioenergy in a holistic sense of, you know, if your goal is if you start off and say my goal is transportation, and then you walk backwards from that. I think one of the reports that I think that does that fairly nicely was the NRDC report that you were involved with too, that was published in 2004. I think it's called Refueling America. And Leland was involved in it, John Sheehan was involved, a lot of really good people. And they looked at the question of, I mean, it's a no-brainer. The first thing you want to do is increase your fuel use efficiency per mile. You want to get more miles.